form, and he suited the girl, too, as his burned bits were hidden under his loincloth. As soon as I altered, her eyes lit up.
"Yes," she whispered under her breath. "That's it."
I looked at her, eyes narrowed. "Sorry. Can I help you with something?"
"No, it's nothing. That's a much better shape."
But she was all breathless and excited, and it took her a few moments to regain her poise. I sat down, cross-legged, on the floor, and waited. The girl sat, too. For some reason, she was suddenly more relaxed. Where a minute earlier her words had been slow and cumbersome, now they burst from her in a veritable flood.
"Well, I want you to listen to me very carefully, Bartimaeus," she said, leaning forward with her fingers jabbing against the floor.
I watched them closely, just in case they chanced to jab a chalk line, maybe smudging it a little. I was interested in what she had to say, for sure, but I wasn't going to miss an opportunity of escape. Ptolemy rested his chin upon the back of one hand. "Go ahead. I'm listening."
"Good. I'm so pleased it's worked out so well."
She rocked back and forth on her haunches, almost hugging herself with delight.
"I hardly dared hope that I'd succeed. I had so much to learn, you have no idea. Well, maybe you do," she conceded, "but from a standing start I can tell you it was not much fun."
My dark eyes frowned at her. "You've learned all this in 3 years?" I was impressed, and more than a little doubtful.
"I started not long after I saw you. When I got my new identity papers through, I was able to visit libraries, get books of magic out." "But you hate magicians," I burst out. "You hate what they do, and you hate us spirits too. You told me so to my face, which, I might add, rather hurt my feelings. What's changed that makes you want to call one up?"
"Oh, I wasn't after any old demon," she said. "The whole purpose of my studying all this time, of my mastering these wicked skills, was to summon you."
"Me?"
"You seem surprised." I drew myself up. "Not at all, not at all. What was it that drew you back? My marvellous personality, I suppose, or my sparkling conversation?" She chuckled. "Well, not the personality, of course. But yes, the conversation was what did it for me, what caught my imagination when we spoke before."
In truth, I remembered this conversation too. 3 years had passed, but it seemed longer now, back in the days when my perennial master Nathaniel was still a glum outsider, panting for recognition. It had been during the middle of the Golem Crisis, when London was being beset by the Clay Monster and Honorius the Afreet, that my path crossed Kitty Jones's for the second time. She had impressed me then, both with the force of her personality and with her fierce idealism, qualities rarely mingled in magicians. She was a commoner, scarcely educated, ignorant of everything that had conspired to create her world, but nonetheless defiant and hopeful of change. And more than that, too. She had risked her life to save that of her enemy, a despicable lowlife, someone unfit to so much as lick her boots. My master, this was. Did you guess? Yep, she'd made an impression on me. And on my master, too, come to think of it. I grinned. "So, you liked what you heard, eh?"
"You set me thinking, Bartimaeus, with all your talk of civilizations come and gone. Above all, you said there were patterns to look out for, and I knew I had to find them." One finger jabbed down as she made the point, almost touching the red chalk line. It was close, very close.
"So," she said simply, "I went looking."
Ptolemy adjusted the corner of his loincloth. "All very well, but that's a different thing from cruelly ripping an innocent jinni from his place of rest. My essence is in sore need of respite. Mandrakes kept me in service." I made a rapid finger-and-toe calculation. "For 683 days out of the last 700. And that has its effects. I'm like an apple at the bottom of a barrel. Sweet and fair to look at, but bruised to a pulp beneath the skin. And you've taken me from my place of healing." Her head was tilted. She looked up at me from under her brows.
"The other place, you mean?"
"That is one of its names."
"Well, I'm sorry to have disturbed you," She spoke as if all she'd done was rouse me from a little nap. But I didn't know I could even do it. I feared my technique might be faulty.
"Your technique's fine," I said. "In fact, it's good. And that leads me to my biggest question. How have you learned to summon me?"
She shrugged modestly. "Oh, it wasn't so hard. You know what I think? The magicians have been exaggerating the difficulty for years, just to put the commoners off. What does it take, after all? A few careful lines drawn with rulers, string, and compass? A few runes, some spoken words? Popping down the market to get some herbs? A bit of peace and quiet, a little memorizing? Do all that and you're sorted."
"No," I said. "A commoner's never done this before, as far as I know. It's unheard of. You must have had help. With the languages, the runes and circles, that noxious plant mix, all of it. A magician."
"Who?" The girl twizzled a strand of hair beside her ear. "Well, I'm hardly going to give you his name. But you're right, I have been helped. Not to do this, exactly, that goes without saying. He thinks I'm more of an amateur enthusiast. If he knew what I was doing, he'd blow his top." She smiled. "Right now he's fast asleep, two floors down. He's rather sweet, really. Anyway, it's taken time, but it's not been too bad. I'm surprised more people haven't given it a go."
Ptolemy gazed at her from under hooded lids. "Most people," I said meaningfully, "are a little nervous of what they might summon." The girl nodded.
"True, but it's not so bad if you're not scared of the demon in question."
I started.
"What?" "Well, I know that terrible things can happen if you get the incantation wrong, or misdraw the pentacle or something, but those terrible things are more or less up to the demon. Sorry, I meant jinni, of course. The jinni in question, aren't they? If it was some old afrit that I'd never met, I'd obviously be a bit worried, in case we got off on the wrong foot. But we know each other already, don't we, you and I?"
She gave me a winning smile.
"And I knew you wouldn't harm me if I made any little mistake."
I was watching her hands, which once again were gesticulating in the vicinity of the red chalk line. "Is that so?"
"Yes. I mean, we more or less teamed up last time, didn't we? You know, with that golem. You told me what to do. I did it. Good partnership, that was."
Ptolemy rubbed the corners of his eyes. "There was a small difference then," I sighed, "which it seems that I must spell out for you. 3 years ago we were both under the heel of Mandrake's boot. I was his slave, you were his quarry. We had a shared interest in foiling him and ensuring our own survival."
"Exactly," she cried, "and we—"
"We had nothing more in common than that," I went on imperturbably. "True, we had a bit of a chinwag. True, I did give you a few clues about the golem's weaknesses, but that was merely in a scientific spirit, to see how perversely your odd little conscience would behave. And mighty perverse it was, too."
"I don't accept—"
"If I might be allowed to get a word in edgeways," I said, "I will just point out the salient difference between then and now. Then we were both victims of the magicians. Agreed?"
"Right.
But now, one of us, i.e. moi," I tapped my bare brown chest, "is still a victim, still a slave. As for the other one, she's changed sides."
She shook her head.
"No, she's a turncoat.
I'm not.
A two-timing backstabber.
Bartim,
a conniving, treacherous, opportunistic, false-faced traitor who's taken it upon herself to add to my endless years of slavery, who set out to learn the cursed arts, without prompting and without coercion. You can say this much for Nathaniel and the rest. They didn't have any choice in the matter. Most of them were moulded into magicians before they were old enough to know better. But you... you could have taken a dozen different paths. And instead, you decide to enslave Bartimaeus, Sacra al-Jinni, the serpent of silver plumes, the wolf-jawed guardian of the Iroquois. And in your arrogance you consider I'll do you no harm? Well, let me tell you, young madam, You underestimate me at your peril. I am master of 1,000 tricks, 100 weapons. I can... Ouch!
In rather heated fashion, I had been ornamenting my argument with a series of brisk finger jabs, one of which overshot the mark and touched the red chalk of my pentacle. With a small explosion of yellow sparks, my essence was rebuffed. I was tossed up and backward, head over heels, frantically pedalling in mid-air to avoid crossing the line on the other side. With the agility born of desperation, I managed it, and sank down to earth with blackened face and my loincloth torn asunder. The girl considered the latter with a disapproving twist of the mouth.
"Tusk," she said, "we're back to square one."
I delicately rearranged the fragments of cloth.
"The point remains. By summoning me, you've redefined our roles. There can be nothing but hatred between us."
"Oh, rubbish," she said. "How else was I to get hold of you? I'm not enslaving you, you idiot. I wanted to discuss something with you as equals."
I raised what remained of my eyebrows.
"Hardly feasible. Do dust mites confer with lions?"
"Oh, stop being so sniffy. Who's Nathaniel, anyway?"
I blinked at her uncertainly.
"Who? Never heard of him."
"You just referred to someone called Nathaniel."
"No, no, you must have misheard."
I changed the subject swiftly.
"The whole idea is ridiculous, anyway. Equality is impossible between humans and djinn. You are young and foolish, so perhaps I shouldn't be too hard on you, but the notion is misguided. I have known 100 masters over 5,000 years, and whether their pentacles have been drawn on the desert sand or on the turf moss of the steppe, the enmity between me and my summoners has been great and everlasting. So it has always been, so it shall always be." I finished in resounding, plangent tones that brooked no argument. They echoed dramatically back and forth across the empty room. The girl smoothed back her hair.
"Absolute tripe," she said. "What about you and Ptolemy?"
Chapter 15
Kitty.
Kitty knew immediately that her theory had been correct. The djinn's response told her so. Since his accident at the margins of the pentacle, the young Egyptian boy had been facing her, chest and chin thrust out, hands sweeping this way and that, to illustrate his expansive statements, and occasionally return his loincloth to position. As soon as she spoke, however, all his blustering and bravado instantly ceased. A great stillness came over him. The face became quite frozen, the body utterly transfixed, as if somehow caught in time. Only the eyes moved. Slowly, very slowly, the pupils shifted to fix their gaze on her. The boy's eyes had always seemed dark, but now they had become quite black. Without wishing it, Kitty found herself staring into them. It was like looking at a clear night sky. All black and cold and infinite, with tiny lights glinting, unreachable and far away. It was terrible, yet beautiful. She was drawn to it as a child to a window. She had been sitting safely in the centre of her pentacle. Now she half uncrossed her legs and leaned forward, supporting herself on one arm, stretching out the other, reaching up slowly toward the eyes, toward their solitude and emptiness. Her fingers trembled above the fringes of her circle. She sighed, hesitated, reached out. The boy blinked, his eyelids flicking like a lizard's. The spell was broken. Kitty's skin crawled. Her hand jerked back. She shrank into the centre of the circle, fresh sweat beading on her brow. Still the boy did not move.
"What do you presume?" a voice said. "To know about me?"
It had sounded all around her, not loudly, but very near at hand. A voice different from any that she had heard before. It spoke in English, but the inflection was odd, as if the tongue found the language alien and strange. It sounded close, but also not so, as if dredged up from some incalculable distance.
"What do you know?"
the voice said again, quieter than before. The djinn's lips were still, the black eyes locked on her,
Kitty hunched herself against the floor, trembling, teeth clenched together. Something in the voice unmanned her, but what? It did not speak violently, or with anger, quite. But it was a voice of power, from a far-off place, a voice of terrible command. And it was a child's voice, too. She lowered her head and shook it dumbly, gazing at the floor.
"Tell me!"
Now there was anger in the voice. As it spoke, a great noise sounded in the room. A thunderclap that shook the window and rippled out across the floorboards, sending chips of rotten plaster dropping from the walls. The door slammed shut, but she had not opened it, nor seen it open. The window shattered and fell away. At the same time, a great wind rose up around the chamber, whirling all about her, faster and faster, sending the bowls of rosemary and rowan wood flying, slamming them out against the walls, seizing the book and the candlesticks, her satchel and her coat, carrying them high and low around the room, whistling and wailing, around and around and around until they blurred. And now the very walls were moving too, tearing from their sockets in the floor, and joining in the frenzied dance, spitting bricks loose as they spun, spiraling around and around beneath the ceiling. Finally the ceiling was gone, and the awful immensity of the night sky stretched above, with stars and moons spinning, and the clouds being drawn out into pale white threads that shot in all directions, until the only still points in all the universe were Kitty and the boy inside their circles. Kitty clapped her fingers across her eyes and buried her head between her knees.
"Please stop!" she cried. "Please!"
And the tumult ceased. She opened her eyes, saw nothing. Her hands were still clamped to her face. With stiff and painful care, she raised her head and lowered her hands. The room was exactly as before, as it had always been. Door, book, candlesticks and window, wall, ceiling, floor. Beyond the window, a placid sky. All was quiet, except the boy in the opposing pentacle was moving now. Bending his legs slowly, slowly, then sitting with abrupt finality, as if all the energy had gone out of him. His eyes were closed. He passed a hand wearily in front of his face. He looked at her then, and the eyes, though dark, had nothing of their former emptiness. When he spoke, his voice was back to normal, but it sounded tired and sad. "If you're going to summon Jin," he said, "you summon their history with them. It's wise to keep matters firmly in the present, for fear of what you might awaken." With great difficulty, Kitty forced herself to sit upright and face him. Her hair was wet with perspiration. She ran a hand through it and wiped her forehead.
"There was no need for that. I merely mentioned—"
"Her name. You ought to know what names can do." Kitty cleared her throat. The first surge of fright was wearing off, to be fast replaced with a teary feeling. She fought it down.
"If you're so keen to keep matters in the present," she gulped furiously, "why do you persist in wearing his form?"
The boy frowned. "You're a little too clever today, Kitty. What makes you think I'm wearing anyone's guise? Even in my weakened state, I can look how I please." Without stirring, he changed his shape once, twice, half a dozen times, each form more startling than the last, each one sitting in exactly the same position in the circle. He finished as a giant rodent of some kind, plump and fluffy, with hind legs crossed and forelegs folded irritably. Kitty did not blink.
"Yes, but you don't generally go around as a king-sized hamster," she snapped. "You always revert to the same dark kid in a loincloth. Why? Because it means something to you. That's obvious. It's someone important from your past. All I had to do was work out who."
The hamster licked a pink paw and smoothed a tuft of fur behind one ear. "I don't acknowledge that there's any truth in those far-fetched statements," it said. "But I'm curious. Where did you go from there? The boy could have been anyone." Kitty nodded.
"True. It happened this way.
After our last meeting, I was keen to speak with you again. All I knew about you was your name, or one of them, Bartimaeus, which was tough enough, since I didn't even know how to spell it. But I knew that if I looked hard, you'd turn up in the historical record somewhere. So when I began to study, I kept my eyes peeled for mention of you.
The hamster nodded modestly. I imagine that it didn't take long. There must be countless references to my exploits.
In fact, it took almost a year to find the slightest mention. I got the names of plenty of other demons of all sorts, here and there, among the library books. Nauda the Terrible kept coming up, as did an Afrit named Chu, and something called Fakwal was notable too in a dozen cultures. And then at last you appeared, a fleeting mention in a footnote.
The hamster bristled.
What? Which books did you look in?
All the best ones must have been taken out.
A footnote, indeed.
It continued, muttering indignantly into its fur.
My problem, Kitty said hastily, was that you weren't always known as Bartimaeus. So even when you had long, long, very important mentions, I couldn't pick up on it. But the footnote helped me out, you see, because it linked the name I knew, Bartimaeus of Uruk, to two others. Sakr al-Jinni, wasn't that your Persian one? And Wakonda, of the Algonquin. After that, I was able to get more references to you here and everywhere I looked. And so I proceeded. I learned a bit about some of your tasks and ventures, and discovered the names of several of your masters, which was interesting, too.
Well, I hope you were impressed, the hamster said. It still sounded rather put out.
Of course, Kitty went on. Very. Did you really speak with Solomon?
The hamster grunted. Yeah. Only a brief chat. All the same, it seemed a little mollified.
All the while, Kitty said, I was learning the art of summoning. My master was rather slow, and I was slower, I'm afraid. But I was gradually getting to the stage when I felt I might call you. But I still had no clue to the identity of this boy, which was a pity, because I knew he was important to you. And then I suddenly found the vital clue. I discovered your Egyptian name, Rekit, and linked that to the magician Ptolemaeus.
She broke off, grinning with triumph. Even so, the hamster said. What did that tell you? I have had 100 masters, and whether their pentacles have been drawn on the sand or the steppe, the enmity...
Yes. Kitty waved the hamster into silence. That was exactly the point. One account mentioned a close bond between this Ptolemaeus and his slaves. It also mentioned that he was only a boy when he died. That's when it became clear to me. That's when I realized the identity of your favorite guise.
The hamster was busy cleaning one of its toenails.
And what details, it asked lightly, might the account have given about the relationship between the jinni and the boy? Just out of interest, you understand?
Not a lot, Kitty admitted. In fact, nothing. I don't think anything much is known about Ptolemaeus as a person any more. Some of his writings survived, I believe. They mentioned a thing called Ptolemy's Gate, whatever that is. She broke off. The hamster was staring out of the window at the midnight moon. At last it turned its head to her, and as it did so, reverted back to the familiar shape of the boy magician, Ptolemy of Alexandria.
Enough, the boy said. What is it you want from me?
Now that her guess had been confirmed, Kitty found her perception of the jinni's guise had completely changed. It was a curious and disconcerting thing to realize that she was looking into the face of a real boy 2,000 years dead. Previously, she had viewed the guise merely as a mask, a costume, one illusion among many. Now, while acknowledging that still to be true, she could not help but sense the ancient presence. That the demon was reproducing the boy accurately, she had no doubt. For the first time, she noticed two moles on the thin brown neck, a little pale scar running beneath the chin, a particular boniness of the elbows on the slender arms. There was a devotion to detail here that could only come with genuine affection, or perhaps even with love. This knowledge gave her confidence to proceed.
Okay, she said. I'll tell you. But first, I want to repeat.
I am not going to enslave you. Whatever your response, I'll set you free.
That's mighty big of you, the boy said.
All I want is for you to listen fairly to what I have to say.
Well, if you actually get on with it, I might give it a try.
The jinni folded its arms.
I'll tell you one thing that's in your favour, though,
it went on ruminatively.
In all the centuries of my burden, not one single magician has been interested enough even to ask about this guise. Why should they? I'm a demon, and therefore willfully perverse. I have no motives but wickedness and temptation. Through general fear and a desire for self-preservation, they never ask me anything about myself. But you have done so. You've found things out. I wouldn't say it was clever, because you're human, but it wasn't a bad effort, all in all. So then, it waved a regal hand. Fire away.
Right. Kitty settled herself comfortably. I don't know whether you've noticed, but things have been going from bad to worse in London. The magicians are starting to lose control. Commoners are being sent off to fight. Trades being disrupted. There's a lot more poverty, and that's led to disruption. There's even been riots in some towns. And there's a lot of resentment about demons.
It's as I predicted when we last spoke, the jinni said. People are starting to notice spirits and uncover their own resilience, too. They'll explore the possibilities, then begin fighting back.
Kitty nodded.
But the magicians are responding. The police are cracking down. There's violence, people being arrested and spirited away. Worse things even than that.
It happens, the boy said.
I think that the magicians will be prepared to carry out terrible deeds, Kitty went on, in order to remain in power. There are many secret commoners' groups, but they are weak, divided. No one has the strength to oppose the government.
That will come, the jinni said. In time.
But how much time? That's the issue.
You want a rough guess?
The boy tilted his head, thinking.
I reckon another couple of generations will do it. Say 50 years. That'll allow resilience to build up to the required levels for a successful revolt. 50 years isn't too bad. With luck, you might see it happen when you're a sweet old granny, dandling big fat babies on your knee.
Actually, he held up a hand, interrupting Kitty's cry of protest.
No, that's wrong. My projection is incorrect.
Good.
You'll never be a sweet old granny. Let's say sad, lonely old Biddy instead.
Kitty banged her fist against the floor.
50 years isn't good enough. Who knows what the magicians will have done by then? My whole life will have gone by. I'll probably be dead when the revolution comes.
True, the boy said. But I'll still be here to watch it. I'll be exactly the same.
Yes, Kitty snarled. Aren't you lucky?
You think so?
The boy looked down at his cross-legged form. He was sitting straight-backed, legs folded neatly in the manner of an Egyptian scribe.
It's 2,129 years since Ptolemy died, he said. He was 14. 8 world empires have risen up and fallen away since that day, and I still carry his face. Who do you think's the lucky one?
Kitty made no answer.
At length she asked,
Why do you do it? Take on his shape, I mean?
Because I promised myself, the jinni said. I'm showing him how he was, before he changed.
But I thought he never grew up, Kitty said.
No, that's right, he didn't.
Kitty opened her mouth to ask a question, but shook her head instead.
We're getting off the point, she said firmly. I can't afford to wait and watch while the magicians do more wicked things. Life's too short. Action is needed now. But we, the people, the commoners, can't unseat the government on our own. We need help.
The boy shrugged. That may well be.
So my idea, or my proposal, really, Kitty said, is that the jinn and other spirits give us that help.
She sat back.
The boy looked at her.
Say again. You help us out. After all, like you said just now, we're all victims here, both jinn and commoners. The magicians subjugate us the same, whether we're human or spirit. So,
We can team up and defeat them.
The boy's face was expressionless. Just like that.
Well, it's not going to be easy, of course. But there's bound to be a way. For instance, if commoners like me can summon important djinn like you, why can't we take on the government together? It needs a bit of thought, and a lot more deep spirits to get involved. But we'd have the advantage of surprise, wouldn't we? And it would be so much more effective for us to fight as an equal force. No slaves, no masters. No scrapping among ourselves or undermining each other. Just smooth cooperation. We'd be unstoppable.
She was leaning forward in the pentacle now, eyes bright and shining with her vision. The boy seemed transfixed, too. For a long while he did not answer. At last he spoke. Insane, he said.
Nice hair, nice outfit, but quite mad.
Kitty squirmed with frustration.
You just have to listen.
Quite a few of my masters over the years have been mad, the boy continued. I've had religious zealots beating their bottoms with brambles, dead-eyed emperors joylessly committing mass murder, misers lusting after hordes of gold. I've had countless abusers of themselves and others.
You are a perverse and unappetizing species.
I'll go as far as to say that your particular madness, Kitty, is less harmful than most, but it will lead to your death, and to mine also, if I'm not careful, so I'll be frank with you. What you have just suggested is ridiculous in a thousand ways, and if I went through them all, we'd still be here when the British Empire finally does fall. So let me single out two reasons. No jinni, no afrit, no city-trampling married or skin-tickling mite will ever, ever team up, as you put it, with any kind of human. Team up, I ask you. Do you see us all wearing the same jersey or something, going into battle hand in hand?
The boy laughed, a harsh, unpleasant sound.
No. We've suffered too much pain for us ever to view a human as an ally.
That's a lie, Kitty shouted. I say again, what about Ptolemy? He was unique.
The boy clenched his fists.
He was the exception. Don't bring him into this.
He disproves everything you've said, Kitty shouted. Sure, it would be difficult to persuade most demons, but
difficult? It could never be done.
That's what you said about me, learning enough to summon you, but I did it.
Utterly irrelevant. Let me tell you something. I've been sitting here talking nicely, keeping pretty manners as a jinni will, but all the time I've been watching you like a hawk, waiting to see if you stuck so much as a toe outside the circle. If you had, I'd have been onto you faster than blinking, and you'd have learned something about humans and demons then, I can tell you.
Yeah, Kitty sneered. Instead of which you stuck your own stupid toe out and blew your skirt off, which more or less sums up your last few thousand years. You're going nowhere on your own, pal.
Is that so?
The boy's face was livid with fury.
Well, let me get on to the second reason why your plans are dud, shall I? Even if I wanted to help you, even if 100 other djinn almost as potent as me shared that sentiment and wanted nothing better than to cast their lot in with some oat-brained humans, we couldn't. Because the only way we can come to Earth is through summoning. And that means losing free will. It means pain. It means obeying your master. And there's no equality in that equation.
Rubbish, Kitty said. It doesn't have to be that way.
Of course it does. What's the alternative? Every summons binds us. That's what they do. Would you seek some way to let us off the leash with our power? Would you be happy to give us control?
Of course, Kitty said stoutly. If that was what it took.
You wouldn't. Not in a million years.
I would. If the trust was there, I'd do it.
Is that so? Well, why not prove it right now? Step out of your pentacle.
What?
You heard me well enough. Step out across those lines. Yes, those ones right there. Let's see this trust of yours in action, shall we? Give me power for a moment. Let's see you put your money where your mouth is.
As he spoke this, the boy sprang up, and after a moment Kitty did so too. They stood in the opposing pentacles, staring at each other. Kitty bit her lip. She felt hot and cold at the same time. This wasn't how she'd intended it to go. Rejection of her proposal followed by an immediate challenge. She hadn't imagined it this way at all. What to do now? If she broke the summons by stepping from the pentacle, Bartimaeus would be able to destroy her before vanishing. Her resilience would not prevent him from tearing her apart. The idea of this set her flesh trembling beneath her clothes. She looked into the face of the long-dead boy. He smiled at her in what was evidently intended to be an amiable fashion, but the eyes were hard and mocking. "Well," he said, "how about it?"
"You've just told me," she said huskily, "about what you would do to me if I broke the protections. You said you'd fall upon me faster than blinking."
The smile flickered. "Oh, don't pay any attention to that. I was only bluffing. You don't need to believe everything old Bartimaeus says now, do you? I'm always joking, you know that." Kitty said nothing.
"Go on," the boy continued. "I won't do anything to you. Put yourself in my power for a moment. You might be surprised. Put your trust in me."
Kitty ran the tip of a dry tongue against her lower lip. The boy smiled harder than ever. He put such effort into it that the surface of his face was taut and straining. She looked down at the chalk marks on the floor, then at her foot, then at the chalk again.
"That's the ticket," the boy said.
Kitty suddenly realized that she had forgotten to breathe. She exhaled violently.
"No," she gasped. "No, that won't achieve anything."
The dark eyes watched her, the mouth a sudden line. "Well," the Jinni said sourly, "I admit my hopes weren't high."
"It's not about the trust," she said, lying. "It's that you'd simply dematerialize. You can't stay on Earth without the power of the summons, and I haven't got the energy to summon you again right now. The point is," she went on desperately, "that if you and other djinn joined forces with me, we could defeat the magicians and stop them summoning you. After we'd defeated them, you'd never be called on again."
The djinni snorted. "I've no time for fantasies, Kitty. Listen to yourself. Even you don't believe a word you're saying. Well, if that's all, you might as well dismiss me." The boy turned his back on her. At this, a great rage surged through Kitty. Memories of the last 3 years swam before her eyes. She felt again the enormous effort it had taken to get this far. And now this proud and blinkered spirit was rejecting her ideas out of hand. It hadn't even given them a moment's fair and considered thought. True, the details had to be worked out. There were many issues to be resolved. But clearly some kind of cooperation was both possible and necessary. She felt close to tears, but furiously drove the sensation away. She stamped her foot, making the floor reverberate.
"So," she snarled, "that stupid Egyptian boy was good enough for you, was he? You put your faith in him, happily enough. Then why not me? What did he do for you that I couldn't? Well, or am I too lowly to hear about his great deeds?"
She spoke bitterly, savagely, contempt for the demon rising like gall inside her. He did not turn to look at her. Moonlight spilled over his bare back and stick-thin limbs. "For one thing, he followed me to the other place." Kitty found her voice at last.
"But that's...
it's not impossible. It's just not done."
"I don't believe it."
"You don't have to. But Ptolemaeus did. I challenged him to prove his trust in me, too. And that was the way he did it. By devising the Gate of Ptolemy. He went through the four elements to find me, and he paid the price as he guessed he would. After that, well, if he'd proposed a hare-brained union of commoners and djinn, perhaps then I'd have gone along with it. There was no limit to our bond. But for you, well-intentioned as you are... sorry, Kitty. I think not." Finally the boy turned, his face hidden in shadow. "What Ptolemy did was unique," he said softly. "I wouldn't ask it of anyone else. Not even you."
"Did it kill him?" she asked.
He sighed. "No."
"Then what price?"
"My essence is a little vulnerable today," Bartimaeus said, I'd be grateful if you would keep your word and let me go.
I'm going to, but I do think you might stay and talk a little more. What Ptolemy did doesn't have to be unique. Maybe it's just that no one since knows much about this gate thing.
The boy laughed shortly. Oh, they know all right. Ptolemy wrote about his journey. Some of his notes survived. Like you, he talked a lot of nonsense about a truce between magicians and djinn. He hoped others would follow his example, take the same risk he did. And over the years a few did try, more out of greed and the lust for power than with his idealism. It didn't go well for them.
Why not?
No answer came. The boy looked away.
All right. Say nothing, she cried. I don't care. I'll read Ptolemy's notes for myself.
Oh, you understand ancient Greek, do you? He laughed at the expression on her face. Just don't worry about it, Kitty. Ptolemy's long gone, and the modern world is dark and complicated. You can't make a difference. Look after yourself and survive. That's what I do. He prodded at his flesh, or try to. Mandrake very nearly had me killed just now. Kitty took a deep breath. Downstairs, in some book-filled corner of his decaying villa, Mr. Button slept. Next morning he would expect her bright and early to begin the collation of new papers. In the evening she would be at the Frog once more, helping to repair the bar, serving out drinks to passive commoners. Without her secret plan to drive her, these prospects seemed wearisome indeed.
"I don't need your advice," she said harshly. "I don't need anything from you."
The boy looked up.
"Well, I'm sorry if I've deflated you a bit," he said. "But those things needed saying." "I suggest."
Kitty closed her eyes and spoke the command. It was tentative at first, then very quick. She felt a sudden violence in her. She wanted to get rid of him, be done with it. Air moved around her face. Candle smoke filled her nostrils. The demon's voice receded into nothing. She did not need to look to know that he had vanished. And with him, 3 whole years of her hopes and dreams. Chapter 16. Nathaniel. Halfway home from the house of Quentin Makepeace, John Mandrake gave an abrupt command. His chauffeur listened, saluted, and did a U-turn in heavy traffic. They drove to Chiswick at top speed. Night had fallen. The windows of the Frog Inn were dark and shuttered. The door was barred. A rough handwritten sign had been posted in the porch. "Sam Webber's funeral takes place today. We are closed. Reopening tomorrow." Mandrake knocked repeatedly, but drew no response. The wind gusted along the drab grey Thames. On the shingle, seagulls fought over scraps deposited by the tide. A red vigilance sphere in the courtyard pulsed as he departed. Mandrake scowled at it and returned to central London. The matter of Kitty Jones could wait. That of Bartimaeus, however, could not. All demons lied. This was an incontrovertible fact. So, in truth, Mandrake should not have been particularly startled that his slave conformed to type. But when he learned that Bartimaeus had concealed the survival of Kitty Jones, the shock affected him profoundly. Why? In part, because of the image he had built up of the long-dead Kitty. For years her face had drifted in his memory, spotlit by a guilty fascination. She had been his mortal enemy, yet she had sacrificed herself for him. It was a gesture that Mandrake could scarcely comprehend, but its strangeness, together with her youth, her vigour, and the fierce defiance in her eyes, had taken on a bittersweet allure that never failed to pierce him. The dangerous resistance fighter he had hunted down so long before had, in the quiet, secret places of his mind, become something pure and personal, a beautiful rebuke, a symbol, a regret. Many things, in fact, all far removed from the original living, breathing girl. But if she lived... Mandrake felt a surge of pain. It was the sensation caused by the destruction of this peaceful inner shrine, by a sudden rush of confusion and renewed memories of the actual messy past, by waves of anger and disbelief. Kitty Jones was no longer a private image in his head. The world had reclaimed her. He felt almost bereaved. And Bartimaeus had lied to him. Why had he done so? To spite him, certainly. But this did not seem quite enough. Well, then, to protect Kitty. But that presupposed a closeness between girl and Jinny, some kind of bond. Could this be so? Mandrake felt a jealous knowledge in the pit of his stomach that it was so. The notion coiled and slithered deep inside him. If the motive for the Jinny's lie was hard to fathom, the timing of the revelation could not have been more bitter, coming so soon after Mandrake had jeopardized his career to save his servant's life. His eyes burned as he recalled the act. His folly rose up to choke him. In the midnight solitude of his study, he made the summons. 24 hours had passed since he had dismissed the frog. Whether Bartimaeus's essence would have healed by now, he did not know. He no longer cared. He stood ramrod stiff, hands drumming incessantly on the desk before him, and waited. The pentacle remained cold and quiet. The incantation echoed in his head. Mandrake moistened his lips. He tried again. He did not make a third attempt, but sat down heavily in his leather chair, seeking to suppress the panic that rose within him. There could be no doubt. The demon was already in the world. Someone else had summoned him. Mandrake's eyes burned hot into the darkness. He should have predicted this. One of the other magicians had disregarded the risk to the Jinni's essence and had sought to find out what he knew about the Jenkins plot. It hardly mattered who it was. Whether Farrah, Mortensen, Collins, or another, the outlook for Mandrake was grim indeed. If Bartimaeus survived, he would doubtless tell them Mandrake's birth name. Of course he would. He had already betrayed his master once. Then his enemies would send their demons, and he would die alone. He had no allies, he had no friends. He had lost the support of the Prime Minister. In 2 days, if he survived, he would be on trial before the Council. He was on his own. True, Quentin Makepeace had offered his support, but Makepeace was quite probably deranged. That experiment of his, that writhing captive, the memory of it repelled John Mandrake. If he managed to salvage his career, he would take steps to stop such grotesque activities. But that was hardly the priority now. The night progressed. Mandrake sat at his desk, thinking. He did not sleep. With time and weariness, the troubles that beset him began to lose their clarity. Bartimaeus, Farrah, Devereux, and Kitty Jones, the council, the trial, the war, his endless responsibilities, everything merged and flickered before his eyes. A great yearning rose in him to cast it all off, remove it like a wet and fetid set of clothes, and step away, if only for a moment. A thought occurred to him, wild, impulsive. He brought out his scrying glass and ordered the imp to locate a certain person. It did so swiftly. Mandrake rose from his chair, conscious of the strangest feeling. Something dredged from the past, almost a sorrow. It discomforted him, but was pleasant, too. He welcomed it, though it made him uneasy. Above all, it was not of his current life. It had nothing to do with efficiency or effectiveness, with reputation or with power. He could not rid himself of the desire to see her face again. First light. The skies were leaden grey, and the pavements dark and sloughed with leaves. The wind skittered through the branches of the trees and around the stark spire of the war memorial in the centre of the park. The woman's coat was turned up against her face. As she approached, striding swiftly along beside the road, head down, hand up against her scarf, Mandrake failed to recognise her at first. She was smaller than he recalled, her hair longer and a little flecked with grey. But then from nowhere, a familiar detail, the bag she carried her pens in. Old, battered, recognisably the same bag. He shook his head in wonder. He could buy her a new one, a dozen of them, should she wish it. He waited in the car until she drew almost level. uncertain until the last moment whether he would actually step out. Her boots scattered the leaves, tripped carefully around the deeper puddles, walking speedily thanks to the cold and the moisture in the air. Soon she would be past him. He despised himself for his hesitation. He opened the roadside door, got out, and stepped across to intercept her. "Miss Lutyens?" He saw her give a sudden start, and her eyes dart around to appraise him and the sleek black car parked behind. She walked another two hesitant steps, came to an uncertain halt. She stood looking at him, one arm hanging limply at her side, the other clutching at her throat. Her voice, when it came, was small, and he noted, rather scared.
"Yes? Might I have a word?"
He had chosen to wear a more official suit than was his wont. He hadn't needed to do this exactly, but he'd found he wanted to make the best impression. Last time she'd seen him, he'd been nothing but a humiliated boy.
"What do you want?"
He smiled. She was very defensive. Goodness knows what she thought he was. Some official come to inquire about her taxes.
"Just a chat," he said.
"I recognized you, and I wondered if you recognized me." Her face was pale, still etched with worry. Frowning, her eyes scanned his.
"I'm sorry," she began. "I don't... Oh, yes, I do. Nathaniel."
She hesitated.
"But I don't suppose I can use that name."
He made an elegant gesture.
"It is best forgotten, yes."
"Yes." She stood looking at him, at his suit, his shoes, his silver ring, but mostly at his face. Her scrutiny was deeper than he had expected, serious and intense. Rather to his surprise, she did not smile or display any immediate elation. But of course his appearance had been sudden. He cleared his throat.
"I was passing. I saw you, and, well, it's been a long time."
She nodded slowly.
"Yes. I thought it would... So how are you, Miss Lutyens? How are you keeping?"
"I'm well," she said,
and then almost sharply,
"Do you have a name I am allowed to use?"
He adjusted a cuff, smiled vaguely.
"John Mandrake is my name now. You may perhaps have heard of me."
She nodded again, expressionless.
"Yes, of course. So you're doing... well?"
"Yes. I'm Information Minister now. Have been for the last 2 years. It was quite a surprise, as I was rather young. But Mr. Devereux decided to take a gamble on me, and..." He gave a little shrug. "Here I am."
He had expected this to elicit more than yet another brief nod. But Miss Lutyens remained uneffusive. With slight annoyance in his voice, he said,
"I thought you'd be pleased to see how well it's all turned out, after the last time we saw each other. That was all very unfortunate."
He was using the wrong words, that much he could tell, slipping into the studied understatement of his ministerial life, rather than saying exactly what was in his mind. Perhaps that was why she seemed so stiff and unresponsive. He tried again.
"I was grateful to you, that's what I wanted to tell you. Grateful then, and I still am now."
She shook her head, frowning.
"Grateful for what? I didn't do anything. You know, when Lovelace attacked me. That time he beat me and you tried to stop him. I never got a chance to. As you say, it was unfortunate. But it was also a long time ago."
She flicked a wisp of hair from her face.
"So, you're the Information Minister. You're the one responsible for those pamphlet things they're giving out at the stations."
He smiled modestly.
"Yes, that's me. The ones that tell us what a fine war we're waging, and how only the best young men are signing up for it, that it's a man's job to sail off to America and fight for freedom and security, the ones that say that death is a fit price to pay for the survival of the Empire."
A trifle too succinct, but that's the thrust of it, I suppose.
"Well, well, you've come a long way, Mr. Mandrake."
She was looking at him almost sadly. The air was cold. The magician stuffed his hands in his trouser pockets and glanced up and down the road, searching for something to say.
"I don't suppose you usually see your pupils again," he said. "When they've grown up, I mean. See how they've got on."
"No,"
she agreed.
"My job is with the children. Not with the adults they become."
"Indeed." He looked at her battered old bag, remembering its dull satin interior, with the little cases of pencils, chalks, ink pens, and Chinese brushes. "Are you happy in your job, Miss Lutyens?" he asked suddenly. "I mean, happy with your money and your status and all that? I ask you because I could, you know, find you other employment if you chose. I have influence, and could find you something better than this. There are strategists in the War Ministry, for example, who need people with your expertise to design mass-produced pentacles for the American campaign. Or even in my ministry, we've created an advertising department to better put across our message to the people. Technicians like you would be welcomed. It's good work dealing with confidential information. You'd get a rise in status."
"By the people, I take it you mean commoners?" she asked.
"That's what we're calling them now in public," he agreed. "They seem to prefer it. Doesn't mean anything, of course."
"I see," she said crisply. "Well, no, thank you. But I'm quite all right as I am. I'm sure none of the departments would want an old commoner like me thrust into their midst. And anyway, I still rather enjoy my job. But it is very kind of you, all the same."
She pushed up her coat sleeve and glanced at her watch. The magician clapped his hands together.
"You have to get on," he said. "Listen, why don't I give you a lift? My chauffeur can take you anywhere. Save you being crammed in like a sardine on a bus or train." "No, thank you. You are very kind."
Her face was stony.
"Very well, if that's the way you feel about it."
Despite the chilly air, he felt hot and irritable. Fervently, he wished he had remained within the car.
"Well, it has been a pleasure seeing you again.
Of course, I must ask you to treat what you know in the strictest confidence. Not that I need to mention that, I'm sure," he added, somewhat foolishly. At this, Miss Lutyens looked at him in such a way that he was suddenly transported back half his lifetime, to the days when her rare displeasure cast his schoolroom into desperate shadow. He found himself looking at his shoes.
"Do you really think," she said tartly, "that I'll want to tell the world that I once saw you, the great John Mandrake, our beloved information minister, hanging upside down with your bottom in the air? That I heard your yelps and wails of pain as cruel men beat you? You think I'd tell this? That's really what you think?"
"No, not that. I meant about my name."
"Oh, that." She gave a short, dry laugh. "It may surprise you to know," she went on, "that I've got better things to do with my time. Yes, even I, with my silly little unimportant job, don't have a great desire to betray the children I once worked with, no matter what they've become. Your birth name, Mr. Mandrake, is safe with me. Now I must go. I'm late for my work."
She turned, began to stride off along the pavement. He bit his lip, his anger mixed with distress.
"You're misinterpreting what I'm saying," he cried. "I didn't come here to crow over you. I just didn't get a chance back then to thank you."
Miss Lutyens paused and looked back over her shoulder. Her face had lost its anger.
"No, I think I do understand," she said, "and I am pleased to know it. But you mistake yourself. It was the boy who was grateful to me, and you are no longer that boy. You do not speak for him. We have nothing in common, you and I. I wanted to say that I know you were trying to save me, and—"
"Yes," she said,
"and I'm sorry I didn't. Goodbye, Mr. Mandrake."
Then she was off, walking swiftly away from him among the damp leaves. Chapter 17. Bartimaeus. Another few hours, another summons. Hey, that's the way I like it. A day without enslavement is a day that's wasted, as far as I'm concerned. Let me see. I'd had Mandrake. I'd had the girl. Who would it be this time? After Kitty's surprise appearance in the pentacle, I half expected this one to be the postman. No such luck. It was my dear old master again, face like thunder, with a silver-tipped spear held ready in his hand. His evident intent stimulated a swift response. I forced my poor old essence into an imposing shape, a lion-headed warrior of the kind that fought in Egypt's wars. Technically, I suppose, I was lioness-headed, since I lacked a mane. Manes are very overrated. Okay, they're good for posing, but they block out all your side vision in battle, and get terribly claggy with accumulated blood. Leather breastplate, looped bronze skirt, eyes that shone like crystal, fanged teeth glared.